Welcome to episode 6 of Super Entertainment Presents the Television Crossover Universe on the Grand Guignol Network. Coming to you from Castle Wolfenstein, hosted by the TVCU crew. In the studio tonight, we have crazy Ivan Schabowski, Ghostbuster, reanimator, convention panelist, lover of cheese, etc., etc., and via Skype, James Boyachuk, CEO of 18th Wall Productions, and I am Robert Ironsky Jr., author of the Horror Crossover Encyclopedia. We are the TVCU crew. The Television Crossover Universe is a shared fiction of reality in which television series, films, comics, novels, video games, and so much more are demonstrated to coexist through crossover connections. More on the TVCU concept can be found at TelevisionCrossoverUniverse.com, in our Television Crossover Universe Facebook forum, in a series of Television Crossover Universe books, and now in this podcast. But this podcast goes beyond the TVCU by bringing on guests whose work relates to crossovers and expands shared realities. So welcome back for another week, Ivan and James. Thanks for still sticking it out with me.
Hi, Robert. It's good to be back.
All right. So we will start with our usual shameless plugging segment. Last week I started with Ivan, so I guess I'll go with James first. James, what would you like to plug?
By the time this releases, we're drawing to the close of a prolific month for 18th Wall Productions. We'll have released one online exclusive novel, The Curious Case of the Clockwork Doll by Heidi J. Hewitt. We'll also have released the very first Scarlet Chase novel by Nicole Petit, which is the Dragon Lord's secretary, and a short story collection by Hannah Lakoff, After the World Ended. And all of them have crossovers for you to find and discover and enjoy at your leisure. And in just a few days, in the beginning of February, we're going to be releasing a survivalist novel of people trapped in the wilderness struggling to use anything they can find, including trash bags, plastic ties, and sandwich bags to escape a blizzard.
Nice.
That one, unfortunately, does not have crossovers, but I'm sure you can make some up as you go along.
I'm just imagining using sandwich bags to survive.
They're used as gloves. It's actually pretty clever. Mm. And stuffed with twigs and leaves to try and make some insulation. It's interesting.
Mm. All right. And how about you, Ivan?
Well, I've started working again on a short story I originally planned on writing a while back. It's a follow-up to that Frankenstein's monster story I wrote a couple years ago.
Which is in the Horror Crossover Encyclopedia as referenced. Yeah.
So this story is, again, it's from the monster's point of view, and he's going to be relating some of his history and how it differs from what people think about the monster.
Nice.
Okay. Want to give us some spoilers and then tell everyone where they can buy the first one and thrill to it? Because it's a fun story.
The first one was published on an e-zine that I'm not even sure it's carried on Amazon anymore. It's called Psychopomp. It was in their first Halloween special. And, like I said, I don't know that it's actually available through Amazon anymore, but you might be able to find it. Maybe it's free. I don't know.
I'm fairly certain it's still there, because I remember I had to go and re-download it for a new Amazon profile.
Ah, okay. And that one had several crossovers thrown in. It was the Frankenstein Monster. It had the Frog Brothers from Lost Boys. It had several elements from the Return of the Living Dead movies. Yeah. And other stuff thrown in to see if you're paying attention.
A reference to Frasier.
It did have a reference to Frasier, yes.
Yeah.
So the new one, I don't really want to tell any of the crossovers I'm planning, obviously.
So we can find them.
Right. But the title of the story is a play on the title of, Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus. Mm-hmm. This one is The Modern Pygmalion.
So, okay. I like that.
Can give you a little clue about what he's going to be going over in his life experiences, mm-hmm. if you can call it life for him.
Right, right. Interesting. All right.
So that's all I got.
All right.
How about you, Rob? What have you been doing lately?
Well, my shameless plugging this week is going to be really shameless. I'm going to tell you lots of different ways you can give me money. So, of course, I have books on Amazon, and you can just search for my name, Robert Ironsky Jr., and those books will pop up, and hopefully in the near future, more books will appear there. Right now, it's just the Horror Crossover Encyclopedia and Intelligent Crossover Universe Worlds and Mythology Volume 1, which should be an indication that I'm working on a Volume 2. In addition to that, as a podcast, we're still seeking GoFundMe donations to help pay for our initial studio fees as we're getting off the ground. And also, my publicist and I are filling out our calendar for this year. So if anybody would like me to show up at your bookstore and sign my books, or if you would like to have me appear at one of your conventions, you can contact me at intelligentcrossoveruniverse@gmail.com, and we'll put it on our schedule, because I would like to have your money, because that's the kind of guy I am.
And I'll work for cheese, so if you just need a panelist or something, you know.
Yeah. Anyways, so that's my shameless plugging. Twice the shame. And
more or less.
Yeah. So that's the end of our shameless plugging. We're going to go to commercial, and when we come back, we will have Micah S. Harris, huge crossover writer, on our show. So we will be right back. All right, we are back. James, would you like to introduce our guest, please?
I would love to. Now, I'm going to start a little bit off topic with this introduction, but I think you'll see where I'm going. So, my girlfriend, Nicole, has always described Timothy Zahn's novels as fixing things that couldn't be fixed, connecting things that couldn't be connected, and making it work. And that is what Micah S. Harris does with his novels. He will connect everything from Jules Verne to King Kong to The Shadow to small little occult detectives from 1930s magazines that no one's even thought about in 80 years, to Twin Peaks, and making not only everything work, but making everything connect as if it was always intended to be one concrete whole. He's an incredibly prolific author, and he's been involved with everything from comics, like Heaven's War, which throws C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and Charles Williams up against Aleister Crowley, the one shot that I wish was a series and campaigned with Image to please make a series, Lorna Relic Wrangler, which is a sort of Southern Belle Lara Croft. He has done The Eldritch New Adventures of Becky Sharp, which Ron Fortier called easily one of the best books of 2008. And he has been involved with, let's see what else, Jim Anthony's Super Detective, The Hunters, with Josh... Yeah, with Josh Reynolds. Yes, thank you. Which is this fantastic combination of Zaroff the Hunter, King Kong, and so many other 1930s things. And most recently, he has done Ravenwood's Stepson of Mystery, Return of the Dugpa, which is at once a prequel to King Kong, a prequel, and a prequel to Twin Peaks. Extremely impressive. So, would you like to start, Rob?
Sure, Micah. Welcome.
Yeah, you know, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've been following your work for a while. We've included in our Intelligent Crossover Universe website many of your works as part of our universe, because you know, you've certainly expanded upon the shared reality, which we call the TVCU. Other people call it by other names. So I wanted to start off. You had previously corresponded with me, and you talked about some of your work that is coming up. So I'm told you have an upcoming mystery novel, which you said probably has one of the most unlikely occult detectives ever. And this book, you said, was inspired by Twin Peaks, and also features some alternate universe versions of your Lorna Relic Wrangler characters. Would you like to share a little bit more on that?
I was working on it when you call, right? So when you call, I've been plugging holes in it all day and refining things. This is a book where the Lorna character appeared before the comic, but the novel set back for a few years, and then I pulled it out and read it and was, you know, pleasantly surprised that it, I thought it held up pretty well. This is kind of a, James was mentioning that the Lorna was a one shot, and you know he wished it would be a series. I didn't know you lobbied Image for that, James. That's nice. Yeah, they. But this this novel is kind of, you can look at it as either a possible future for the characters in the comic book, and or you may look at it as a parallel world with those characters. And at the same time, no one has known anything about the comic, you know, to just enjoy the mystery. It is set in a small town, not far from where I live, so it's a fictionalized version of that town. And the title is Murder in the Miracle Room. And the premise is that a small town saint who is in a coma, who's stigmatic, has a wealthy father, sort of made a living shrine out of her in this small town. People come in to get their icons blessed and start dripping oil and blood and that kind of phenomena that occurs in such places. And, you know, she's still continuing to bleed from her palms, even in her coma. Someone gets in and turns her, her life support off and kills her, murders her. So, you know, that's the sort of the Twin Peaks parallel partly is that you have a murder, you know, in a small town of a woman. But also it gets into the paranormal. Mm-hmm. It gets into this whole culture in this town that's permeated with a spirit world. And, you know, not all of which is healthy with which to associate.
Nice.
Do you have a publisher lined up yet?
I'm self-publishing this one. This is going to be another minor profit press. People that brought you the Eldritch New Adventures of Becky Sharp and Slouching Toward Camilla Dundrum.
Okay, then be sure to watch all of Micah's self-promotion channels.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, another one you've told me about was you said you had a fairy tale related project coming up that was crossover heavy. Are you able to tell us anything about that?
Yeah, that's one I would rather not go into too much detail right now because I like my hook on it.
Mm-hmm.
My take. But it is in the, you know, what's become a popular genre recently. It kind of interests me. I don't know really why, but I figured it up, and this is not exact, but like in the last 5 years, there have been like 30 movies that were either fairy tale or fantasy related somehow.
Right.
And then, you know, you have the TV shows like Grimm and Once Upon a Time. And, you know, our culture is just really fascinated with fairy tales and a new kind of take on them and, you know, sort of crossing the characters over. So that's what the pitch, you know, it involves, what it will be about. It will be crossing over different fairy tale characters and folklore characters, and you know, hopefully it'll be something not quite like you've seen before. I know Fables has, you know, made a high mark in terms of, you know, handling that kind of material like that, but I won't be trying to emulate that, but hopefully, you know, it'll be as enjoyable.
Nice. I'm a big fan of fairy tale stuff, and I eat that stuff up, so I'm really looking forward to that. I'm also really looking forward to the previous book you just talked about, because theology is one of any kind of fictional version of theology and supernatural mixed together. You know, that's my cup of tea, if you will. Also, I want to talk about from Tales of the Shadow Men. I've read a lot of your stories from Tales of the Shadow Men from Black Oak Press. For those who are listening who don't know, it's an anthology series. It comes out annually, I believe, and has some kind of theme to French characters. usually.
Correct.
And you had the Frequency Affair was one of the stories you had in Tales of the Shadowmen a while back. Now, I've heard that you're going to be publishing an alternate version of that book.
Of the Frequency of Fear?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Frequency of Fear is available right now for 99 cents on Amazon as a download only. It is pretty much the same story. I did change the name of the main character because he's, you know, copyrighted in France, I guess. So I actually had a name for a character, a friend and I, named Tom Gerganis. We used to do a comic strip in the East Carolinian when Jeff Parker, and I know you're familiar with him, from Agents of Atlas. He was the art director, and at that time at the university, we had a nice comics page. And Tom Gerganis and I were doing one, and the main character name was Montag, which I swiped from Fahrenheit 451. But I thought it sounded well.
I recognize that, yeah.
Yeah, but so anyway, I did a double swipe and took out this character, Teddy Verona, and just put in Montag or whatever to... So there'd be no legal problems or anything that I can publish with a clear conscience. But it's pretty much the same story. I hope that I do plan to do a self-published thing with it, with some artwork that my collaborator, Lawson Wallace, who drew Lorna and did the Becky Sharp illustrations. And
excellent stuff, by the way.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Work.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'll be glad to hear that. He did that second issue of the Spirit Rocketeer crossover, and he's doing some more cover. He's done some cover work for IDW. He's doing some more of that, and we're working on another, getting another project going. It's not Lorna, but it is Lovecraftian, and. Again, it's something I think that's pretty different than anything you've seen, as you know, as much as that field has been plowed. I don't think you've quite seen anything like this.
Okay.
So we have that coming up. But he's doing some art for me on my Frequency of Fear thing, and so you know, I'll be so that's something I'll probably just be selling at cons. Kind of a low print run, and he mentioned that we might for that self-published version, you know, have like the old books you flipped over, like an Ace double novel, and you know, from the front it would be the prose Frequency of Fear, and then in the back it would be this comic, this, you know, Lovecraftian comic that we're doing, and yeah, the Frequency of Fear I'm pretty proud of. I would like to see that get more attention. I tried to cross over, you know, different characters from movies and things that all dealt with fear in some fashion, and also plants, interestingly enough, crossing over, you know, bizarre plant life from the movies, living plant life, and I think you actually had a scene. And that were Major Briggs for Twin Peaks at the same table with scientists from Godzilla versus Biollante, you know. So it was quite a you know, quite a cross section of popular culture
covering all the bases.
Yeah. That living plants, you know, bring us all together, I guess.
Yeah,
but.
So speaking of your Lovecraftian project that you just mentioned, would that be slouching towards, I'm going to not say this correctly, Camulodunum? That I did not.
Slouching toward Camulodunum.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hope I'm saying it right. Yeah. Yeah, that was, kind of it touches on both Arthur Machen and Lovecraft. And, you know, I'm sure you know Lovecraft's debt to Machen.
Oh, yeah.
Pickman appears in that. In that scene, it was interesting. That's one of my Vicky Sharp stories. And from Vanity Fair, Thackeray, in her background, Vicky was the child of a painter. Her father was a painter. And it just sort of worked out that in this story, I want to bring together a bunch of fictional painters. That included Pickman. It included Charles Delaware Tate from Dark Shadows. It included Francis Aton, or A-Town, who was cut from Dracula by Stoker. It also included a character that I'm really fond of from the 1950s movie Magnificent Obsession.
Mm-hmm.
And he is quite a character. And he's a painter in that movie. In the novel, I understand, in the Lloyd C. Douglas novel, the guy wrote The Robe. I think he was a sculptor. But they made him a painter. And in this version, and this guy, I tell you, he's something. I mean, it's this weird philosophy he's spewing out that's like a cross between Pay It Forward and The Force. And, he's just really, he's like Ward Cleaver with a pipe.
Yeah.
If you imagine Obi-Wan Kenobi with a pipe in Ward Cleaver mode, you know, as he's talking about this, you know, this energy, and you just got to turn on the light. It's just this really twisted theology that's coming out of Douglas, who did, you know, a rather straightforward Christian novel with The Robe. But this is some kind of weird stuff. But anyway, he appears, Randolph. I believe it is. He appears as one of the painters. And I just love the actor who played him in that. He's just got this sort of benign, fanatic look on his face, you know. And he actually, when he was younger, about 20 years earlier, he was the hero of Dracula's Daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So that actor's got a great character face. And I think it's safe to say I'm probably the first person to cross H.P. Lovecraft over with Lloyd C. Douglas.
Yeah, I can't think of any other.
Very likely you are, yes.
Yeah, I don't. yeah.
Okay. In our correspondence before the interview, you'd also mentioned an upcoming article about the lost fantasy franchise of the 70s and 80s, like Lynn Carter's Thongor of Lemuria books. Would you like to talk about that?
I'm sorry, what you said, an article?
Yeah, an article about Lost Fantasy franchise of the 70s and 80s you'd mentioned.
Oh, okay, yeah. What it is, it's into the publisher at last. It took years to get it to all come together. But the character of Thongor by Lynn Carter...
Mm-hmm.
Was once slated to be start a franchise of movies starring that character. And Thongor is a Conan derivative character. Interestingly, he was the one that Marvel or Stan Lee wanted to go with instead of Conan for the comics. Thongor, probably because it sounds like one of Stan Lee's monsters from the 50s,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But and of course today having a hero with thong in his name is probably the best way to go. But I got really interested in this when I was a teenager back in the 70s in an issue of Starlog. They had an article on it, and they had some pictures of one of the animation models. Because it used to be a big, well, I still like stop motion. I used to be really into it. I wanted to be a stop-motion animator as a profession. And so this stuff interested me just on that level. And then I found the Lynn Carter books and read a couple of those and really enjoyed them. I was 17 at the time, and thankfully my critical faculties had not kicked in because I was just able to have a good time with it, you know. and just enjoy it. And, you know, I go back and look at it now, and it's like, you know, well, not the best writing style or whatever, but, you know, when you're young like that, and it was fun, and I'm sure that's probably what Carter was most intended to do, was to entertain. So I read those books, and then nothing ever happened with the movie. And so I was always interested in that. And over the years, I found references to things that I didn't know existed that had come out in the 70s and 80s talking about it. Some information here and there. Starburst magazine had the most substantial article on it back in the early 80s. And so that intrigued me. And so, you know, thanks to the miracle of the Internet, which gives us access to so many people that we would not have had before, I was able to get in touch with one of the special effects guys, Stephen Archer, who was very, very helpful, also the art director, who was the art director on Excalibur, the John Borman movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped me get in touch with the director, Harley Koklis, who did... he did some episodes of Hercules from the 90s, the Kevin Sorbo thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think maybe some Xena. He does some other things. I think he's a good friend with the comic book artist John Bolton. You know, it's just really incredible. Mm-hmm. In fact, we plan in this article to run a reproduction of John Bolton's storyboards for the opening sequence of Bongor. You know, it's not very tight art by any means, but it is unseen Bolton, you know, that he has his fans. I was able to get in touch with the director and had a good chat with him over the phone. He was the second unit director on The Empire Strikes Back. He was the one that, his unit was the one that filmed the Vader-Luke sword fight in that. And you know, we talked about Fungor and why it did not happen. And you know, it was just an interesting story to me. I'm very interested in projects that didn't come off, that somehow something stopped them, you know, and they did not reach fruition. Maybe it's because I've created so many of them myself. that's something that intrigues me. And so I was happy to you know, be able to do some research, and had some nice people helping me out, and you know, get the kind of the best inside story on Fungor and why he did not appear at all. You know, it's kind of interesting. In a parallel world, there's probably a summer in the 80s where Fungor and Conan are both in the theaters at the same time.
Right.
Dueling Barbarians. Yeah. Yeah. David Prowse was approached about it. But when I spoke to him about that in the 90s at a con, he didn't even remember it, except it just rung a bell with him, you know.
Oops.
Anyway, it was fun doing that and writing the nonfiction and actually being able to do a little bit of being something of a film historian, you know, even if it's in a little corner of the industry there, or the history of the movie, of movies, you know, it's a small part, but it's a tale that is now told or will be told.
Nice. Excellent.
I love that kind of behind the scenes stuff. I'm that guy who watches the DVD commentaries and, you know, listens to them, and yeah, all those extras. So I love those kind of documentary type stuff. James had mentioned the Dugpa in his introduction. Would you like to talk a little bit about Return of the Dugpa?
Oh yes, yeah, very much so. I'm pretty really proud of Return of the Dugpa. Our full name is Ravenwood, the Stepson of Mystery, Return of the Dugpa. Ravenwood is James was mentioning, was just a obscure character. He was a backup feature, you know, didn't even hit on his own magazine. And he had a few stories. They had been collected, and the originals. And Ron Fortier brought Ravenwood back to light. And they produced a couple of, you know, short books of short stories, new short stories. And I had this idea. I was fascinated with the still unsolved murder of William Desmond Taylor, a true life Hollywood crime that is still to this day, nobody knows who killed that man. And just all kinds of weird details and things around it. It's just bizarre. There's even a school, I guess you would say, an informal school who study Taylorology. You know, looking at the death of William Desmond Taylor. And somebody came out with a new book not too long ago on it. It was after I'd done my book. Just recently someone came out with a nonfiction. But I give a fictional, answer for his murder. And it does involve the Douglas, who are in actual order. Or at least I think the name means wizard or something. These are real guys. And my origin of them, of course, is not real. But they do appear in India, I think, around the 14th century. And so in our story, The Return of the Dugpa, we get the story of the first Dugpa and where he came from and, how he started the group, the society there of guys who feed off fear and like to create all the pain and suffering they can. He is their leader. And again, there's a backstory with that. Kind of some stories within stories in that book. But they all do come together, hopefully, to a thrilling climax on the set of the original King Kong.
Okay.
Yeah, but before it was the King Kong set.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a certain blonde kind of going through the paces before she goes through them on Skull Island. So.
Nice. Any hints at any of the other crossovers that might appear in that? Or is that too?
I'm really proud of my crossovers in that. The character, the Dark Eminence. The Dark Eminence. Which is not too hard to figure out who he is. And I actually had him say a few lines that were playing with that, with the wink-wink element of it. He's a character. He could be this other famed pulp character. The way it is now, he could become my own character.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the future holds for Dark Eminence, but it was fun writing him. And this book actually ends up being a prequel to the Jim Anthony book I did with Josh Reynolds.
Right.
Or you may look at it this way. The Jim Anthony book, which was written back in 2008, is a sequel to this book that came out just last year. Yeah. If you read what was happening in chronological order in terms of in the story, you would read Ravenwood, Return of the Dugpa first,
mm-hmm.
and then you would read Jim Anthony, The Hunters. And you
of
would see
course.
The characters reappear.
Someone could argue that you really want to start back in Eldritch New Adventures of Becky Sharp.
You
start there anyway. It's a good book.
I'm
proud of that book. It got to where, Becky had sort of had her run there, for a few years and wasn't selling well at that point. Now I see on Amazon it's going for like $200-something a copy.
I still have my copy.
Yeah, so I can't imagine it's flying off the shelf at those prices. Although it's worth every penny, you know, that you would spend to be able to read that classic. But I would like to bring it back into print. I'd like to bring that back into print. And I talked with my digital prepress guy about it. And the new book, my plan for that would be to take it through CreateSpace. And but the way it's set up, the publisher we went with before, the printer, Kablam, Kapow, that'll have to be altered. And he told me that it would be kind of time consuming to do that, so it would be really pretty expensive to get it reformatted, you know, where it could be, you know, distributed out in a new edition.
Right. Despite you owning the story.
As far as I owe the story. Well, that's a. You know, I would like to, you know, to, like I say, to get it out. And it should probably reemerge later, you know. I'm pretty proud of that book.
Since I take it Rob's out of questions,
yeah,
I'm
just about to turn it over
jump
to you.
Right in. Okay, since we're starting way back with Becky Sharp now, one of your continuing things, and it's been in – I think all of your novels and in some of your short stories is King Kong. Mm-hmm. So would you like to go into one, how you ended up on this theme for Kong, and to chart your secret history of Kong and your different inspirations?
Okay. Well, I've King Kong is my favorite movie, easily number one. And I was, you know, that, when I was a kid, you know, you had the dinosaurs and then the stop motion. And I just, you know, developed a crush on Fay Wray as Andaro as a 10-year-old that continues, you know, 40 years later. It's still going on. Yeah, I thought, you know, that she was just really, really pretty and was really attractive. And that movie, it's just, you know, like I said, it's my favorite. And so I wanted to go back and do Kong stuff when I could bring that in to do a homage here and there to King Kong. I may have one more left in me, which basically would take place in New York. on a certain day, where basically, if you've read or if you're familiar with Becky Sharp and you put the pieces together, you know who Becky's daughter is, and who the father is, let's call him a jungle lord, and. I had thought that it would be kind of interesting because the way the child was conceived was not really the jungle lord's doing. He was basically assaulted or really, you know, raped, if I can say that, you know, I mean, I'm sure she wasn't brutal or anything, but, you know, sex without consent tends to be rape, you know. So he doesn't even know he's a dad. But I thought about having something of a family reunion in New York on the day Kong breaks three with Becky Sharp and the Jungle Lord and their daughter sort of coming together. So that might be the, like I said, the third one, you know, if I wrap it up, and we'll see how that, you know, how that goes. But yeah, Kong, like I said, is very much, my favorite monster, I guess, or my favorite classic monster. But that infatuation with Fay Wray, is what has led me to, you know, take the character who is in Return of the Dugpa and Dara Meshez, or Dara Monsh, and Jim Anthony, the Hunters. And the Hunters, she has different pseudonyms, but the main one's Dana in that one. And Dana Sparrow. and Ann Deramosh are the same person, just under different names in those two books. And writing her character, you know, it's just a continuation of a manifestation of my infatuation with the character of Ann Darrow's Fay Wray portrayed her so, you know, magically. Just so, you know, she brought a lot of charisma to that role. You know, when you bring King Kong out, you can't just stick him with just any blonde. Mm-hmm. You know, just any blonde won't do. You've got to have an actress or a character who has enough charisma that she can hold her own with Kong, you know. And, you know, the Fay Wray character of Ann, her, the way she handled Ann Darrow, had that. And she was really not a, you know, complex character. And, you know, if you were to go to write her out straight, she'd be a pretty flat character. But what, you know, made the difference in that was how she, her Fay Wray's performance and the charisma that she had. But when I sit down to write, you know, I can't get that charisma on the printed page. So I've taken the character and, you know, with some things to give her a different voice, to give her, you know, a different, certainly a different backstory. And, you know, to try to make her interesting that way. But hopefully preserve something of what a charmer Ann Darrow is supposed to be.
Okay. And this is probably a much smaller concern, but it is something I've been curious about since I read Return of the Dugpa. But where did you get the idea for, slash, what was your inspiration for Wagner's Lost Arthurian Opera?
Yeah, wow, where did I get that? Man, I mean, I made it up. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Now, see, Return of the Dugpa has been coming down the chute for a few years. I had moved into my new house a few years ago, and I was starting to write this story. I had been carrying it in my head for a couple years, and different things happened, stuff at work and with moving, and it was a while before I sat down to start typing it. And as I, where my desk is and where my TV is in my bedroom, I can look down the hall if I was playing a DVD and, you know, look up and watch TV while I'm writing. And I have a fascination with this whole, you know, meta text kind of stuff. This whole, something that doesn't exist, but you get a commentary on it anyway. You know, books that, the Necronomicon would be one, but, even things like, Sartor Resartus by Thomas Carlyle, where, he's purportedly, translating a German text into English, but there is no German text. You know, they put it into English. George Louis Borges said that instead of writing a book, he preferred to pretend that it already existed and then write a review of it. You know, so that kind of thing, this idea about fictional text. And what I had on the TV, what I bought, and I'd seen the movie in the theater when it was out, and was hoping to get some inspiration. I think it's called The Ninth Gate. Have you seen that with Johnny Depp?
Yes. Yep. Yes.
Yeah, and so I put that in, and somewhere along the way, the idea of Wagner and that, you know, having a lost opera struck me. I've never read that Wagner had a lost opera, you know, so it's entirely my invention. I did, let me back up with that. he was going, he did have a lost one, that he was trying to do that was Arthurian. Or maybe I've got it turned around. There was one that dealt with Buddhism and with, the denial of self, and these two lovers, who achieve their transcendental state by denying one another.
I can't remember the title of it, but I know what you're talking about.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about? Okay, great. So that's the one that happened. That's the real one. But he was my idea was that before he did that, he tried to do it in Arthurian way at first, an Arthurian take on that. And I want to say that he was maybe doing something with Parsifal and the von Eisenbach version of Parsifal.
Yes, he was trying. And he got like halfway through before he burned his notes for it even. He was so fed up with it.
Is that what it is? Okay. Yeah, so like I said, it's been years since I was putting all that together. So, with that information, I came up with my own Arthurian tale, supposedly by Wagner, and I thought it was a neat idea. Wagner offered with a legit curse on it.
I'm curious to see if anyone tries to pick that up and use it, or thinks it's a real thing.
Because that would be interesting.
Made me think that, is this something I'm not aware of?
Oh, fantastic! I live to deceive, man. That's my job as a writer of fiction. That's great. He actually is something. He had one of these nice bit of serendipity, and that his first opera was based on a story by who is the guy Bolton Wire, the Vril. He wrote about the Vril underground civilization. There's an award in his name for
Walter Lytton, something like that. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name.
Now it's escaping me, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, it turned out that, he had written, Wagner's first opera was based on a story of his. And in my story, I wanted to use the concept of the dweller on the threshold, which I first became aware of in Twin Peaks. And later found out was actually a concept in Theosophy, in the Rise of Theosophy. But it goes back to a book by the same guy, a story by the same guy who wrote Wagner's first opera, what it was based on. So the book Zantui, I can't remember exactly the name of this tome.
I think it's Zanoni.
Is that Noe? Okay, yeah, right. Edward Buller Lytton or something like that.
Yeah, that's
right. Well, he's the one who came up with the dweller on the threshold, although he called it the dweller of the threshold. And so, as in Return of the Dugpa, that's a very key element of the play, of the opera that's being unfolding there before the Order of the Golden Dawn. And so I think it was kind of neat, even though it was fictional, to have Wagner come back to source material from the guy who historically was the source material for his first opera.
That is fun. So since you brought it up.
James, sorry to cut you off, but unfortunately we are running low on time.
No.
I know. I really wish this could go on longer because, Micah, I'm really enjoying listening
to
you.
Well, thank you.
But unfortunately, we do have just an hour for the show. But before we let you go, I wanted to give you an opportunity to plug any new projects that you haven't plugged yet that you'd like people to know about, and also where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, my latest book, Ravenwood, Return of the Dugpa, is available on Amazon. That's from Airship 27. And it's in a, Kindle as well as print. I have another self-published novel. Well, it's a novella and a collection of short stories that have been revised, mostly, just for write, not plot stuff, but they're the preferred text, and that's the slouching toward Camilla Dundrum, and that is the one I'm fond of that story, the main story in that, and then I have some other pastiches in there as well, one with the Count of Monte Cristo meeting Lord Riven the Vampire, and there is an interesting true life Alexander Dumas connection between that. He actually references Lord Riven in the Count of Monte Cristo. Somebody talks in that book as though they think he's a real character. Mm-hmm. I have a story in there who, for legal reasons, I will simply say, features a character I call the Puritan. Yeah. I'm pretty proud of that. Yeah, I think even though it's unauthorized, I think it's one of the better stories, other than what you would get from the creator, other than from the creator of that character, that you would get from somebody else. So I'm pretty proud of that. Frequency of Fear, like I said, that's on Amazon for download for just 99 cents. That's something if anybody is interested in just wanting to try me out as a writer, you know, costs less than a buck. And it would, be something of an introduction in my style, the kind of things I write about in terms of subject matter and you know, genre and the whole kind of mashup sort of thing, or crossovers, you might say. So that's available. And also, the Jim Anthony, The Hunter's book, has come out in an audio version. There's a guy reading it, and Airship 27 is working with a company that produces these, audio versions of their text, and they're putting them in. They're coming out fairly quickly with Airship 27 text, or they're being given the treatment of, you know, becoming a verbal book. Which is cool. That's available on Amazon. You can click on it and get a sample from it. It does turn out that the sample they're using is from my half of the book. So that's available, as well. Becky Sharp, hopefully she will return some way, somehow. I have found that the fans of Becky Sharp tend to be really, really intelligent people, I've noticed. But unfortunately, there's not enough of them, apparently. She's become something of an obscure character. Scarlett O'Hara, I guess, got all her thunder now. Scott Fitzgerald thought that was where, Scarlett O'Hara came from, was that she was at least inspired by Becky Sharp. Those are the texts that are available, and then I do have short stories in the Tales of the Shadow Man anthologies that are available on Amazon. My Lorna Relic Wrangler comic, I think, is still available as you can get it as a download from Image, or the people that Image goes through, to get it legally. So that's still out there. And Heaven's War received a second printing a year ago. And that features art by Michael Gatiss, who is now has become the artist on the series that Jessica Jones he was the artist on the series Jessica Jones is based on. Mm-hmm. Which was Alias. Yeah, there was a time when he was working on both Alias and Heaven's War at the same time, a long time ago. And that's sort of my tie-in with a local, hot property. It's nothing like Jessica Jones, the novel itself, the graphic novel itself. But that's still out there, and I have had a little Hollywood interest in it, actually.
Oh, nice.
I haven't heard anything lately. But what struck me as kind of odd is that these guys who approached me about it they were involved with both one of the Twilight movies and one of the Percy Jackson movies. And it just struck me as odd as thinking, well, you know, these are all very youth-oriented movies. Heaven's right. Door's got a bunch of middle-aged old men walking around the countryside. You know, it's struck me.
Not once but, they're done with it.
Hopefully they're branching out and they're not looking to make anybody sparkle.
Well, so, yeah, hopefully something good with that. You know, the guy did was kind enough to show an interest in it, and hopefully something would come from it. I'd love to see Ian McKellen or Anthony Hopkins, you know, in some of those roles. And
yeah, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, Hopkins reprises C.S. Lewis role from Shadowlands. That would be cool. It'd be kind of twisted, but it would be cool, too. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, Micah, for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, guys, thank you so much for having me.
You're
going
to have to come
it.
Back on because clearly James has a lot more stuff to ask you about.
Yes.
So we will have to have you on again real soon.
Oh, please, please do. Yeah. You know,
it was
if you can't wait, shoot me an email.
Yeah.
I'm approachable.
It was a pleasure having you. So we're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back to wrap up. Well, that's unfortunately all the time we've got for this week. I want to again thank Micah S. Harris for being on our show. It was such a pleasure, and I really wish you had more time. We're definitely going to have him on again. Thanks once more for James and Ivan for joining me on this mad adventure. Please listen to us again next week when we'll be talking with author William Mikeley. Before we end, I want to thank our GoFundMe sponsor from this week who wishes to remain anonymous, and our other sponsor, Hudson University. Dr. Cliff Huxtable, alumni, says the sexual assaults are highly exaggerated. And a special thanks to Tiny White and the Deadites for our show's theme music. Thanks to all who listened. Remember, everything happens somewhere.